WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And Donald Trump's racial politics came from somewhere. And a new book tells the story. It's called The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. It's a detailed history of 50 plus years, but the overarching point is that Trump is not an aberration. He's the culmination of a half century of using coded racist appeals that Trump simply took above ground, coded racial messages that have been strategically merged with traditional gender messages to construct the modern conservative cultural appeal. With me now are the authors of The Long Southern Strategy, and they didn't just parachute into the region. They are Angie Maxwell, professor of Southern Studies at the University of Arkansas, and Todd Shields, the university's Dean of Arts and Sciences. Dean Maxwell, Professor Shields, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
So you trace the history of the GOP using racially coded language. I have a clip of a famous Republican I'll play in a minute that kind of admits the whole game. But before we play it, can you take us back to an early example or two of the coded language you're writing about and why this got started in the first place as code?
Sure. Well, in 1964, there's a big fight within the Republican Party about if it is going to try to, you know, break up, you know, the solid Democratic South as its new kind of electoral map strategy. And that fight's between the Goldwater side of things and the Rockefeller, kind of pro-civil rights wing of the Republican Party. Goldwater gets the nomination, and his surrogates in the South and on his swing through the South really play up the fact that he voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Now, Goldwater is successful in flipping five deep South states in that election, but other than his home state of Arizona, those are the only states he wins. So in 1968, when Nixon gets the nomination, his team decides, we think we need to couch this language a little bit. We need to give people a way of understanding that we're going to maintain kind of a racial hierarchy and have kind of a benign neglect, that's what they called it, of civil rights enforcement without sounding too overt and too abrasive. So there was some kind of deniability. They do that through the phrasing about law and order and the phrasing about states' rights and states' authority.
So here's the clip that I referred to, obtained by The Nation magazine. This is Lee Atwater, who ran George H.W. Bush's presidential campaign in 1988. And these days, of course, we like to think of Papa Bush as a gentle moderate, but he ran partly on the Willie Horton TV commercial, which featured a black man's face while talking about a supposedly race-neutral issue, which was parole. And again, Lee Atwater was Bush's campaign manager in 88. And in 1981, he said in an interview exactly what he was doing. Now, the sound quality on this is not great, but listeners, listen closely, and you'll probably be able to make it out. Just before the part we're going to play, Atwater uses the N-word repeatedly. He said in 1954, you could appeal to whites just saying N-N-N, but that became unacceptable by 1968, so instead,
you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now. You're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing.
Because if that was not comprehensible to some of you, the end of it was because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut this, like cut an economic program, is much more abstract than even the busing thing. And then he finishes that thought by saying again that all of that, forced busing and tax cuts and states' rights, are a way of saying the N-word without saying it in political campaigns. Dean, do you know that famously Atwater clip?
Yes, it's a very famous clip, and it's he's one of the strategists that actually was a partner of the consulting firm with Paul Manafort and others who've been active in recent campaigns as well.
Atwater mentioned busing and states' rights and tax cuts in particular. Your list also includes advocating law and order, Christian nationalism, anti-feminism, which we'll get to in some detail in a minute, and colorblindness. And Professor Shields, that's an interesting one for a white grievance appeal. Explain colorblindness in that context after centuries of conservative policy based on color consciousness.
Sure. Well, you know, in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan had done a massive amounts of data and collection and what was ringing with people. And then the evolution of the racial coded language was changing so that if you could say, hey, we're colorblind, that's the goal, then you could deny the systemic racism, you could deny the historical racism that was still really affecting both communities.
And let's go on to the gender issue, because you're right that often overlooked is how the Southern strategy on race has been merged with anti-feminism to create a white GOP Southern majority. How do the two relate, Professor Maxwell?
Well, this is kind of the crux, I guess, of seeing this as a long Southern strategy. So after, you know, the story we kind of tell is, you know, Goldwater and Nixon do this and the South turns red. But in 1976, the South goes right back to the Democratic Party voting for Jimmy Carter. And so Republicans are really concerned with should they abandon this Southern appeal? And if not, like what do they do? And they do kind of morph their appeal on race, but they also take stock of the fact that Phyllis Schlafly's Stop ERA, which stood for Stop Taking Our Privileges, her anti-feminist campaign had gained huge momentum, particularly among white Southern women, right? She had 1977, she hosts a pro-family, because that's their slogan, rally in Houston that 20,000 people, you know, show up and attend. And our, you know, American attitudes towards the ERA shift really dramatically. So in 1980, Reagan's, team drops the Equal Rights Amendment from their platform in an appeal to kind of not only to men who are supporting like traditional gender roles, but to Southern white women who are as well. And the fact that we've kind of missed that continues to impact us today when we see that, you know, Hillary Clinton won white women outside of the South. She lost them by almost 20 points in the Southern states. But we don't usually break up that data by region, and there's really significant reasons why we need to.
It's fascinating, that you write that the anti-feminism stance was adopted as a central GOP value, especially to appeal to white Southern women. So can you explain how anti-feminism was a strategy to get women's votes?
Well, you know, part of it has to do with just kind of understanding the culture of Southern white womanhood, which is a really old construct dating back to, you know, antebellum times, where the ideal Southern white woman was, you know, placed on a pedestal and needed to be protected all the time from this kind of threat of African-American men. Now, over time, what happens is the, you know, culture around these kind of protected Southern white women builds institutions that, you know, maintain that. And so we see lower vote turnout. We see women not running as much for office, and we see this pushback against feminism and the Equal Rights Amendment, which, you know, passes overwhelmingly bipartisan, you know, through Congress, but fails in all the southern states once Phyllis Schlafly really frames feminism as not a choice, but as an attack on traditional kind of gender roles, right? And that hits really hard among southern white women who have been, you know, not all, of course, but a lot of them conditioned to, you know, kind of live that life.
And to feel that it protected them rather than oppressed them?
Correct.
I didn't realize until reading it in your material, Dean Shields, that the Republican Party once held the Equal Rights Amendment in their platform. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's correct. In the 70s, in the late 70s, the 1977, the year of the woman, every former first lady, Democrats and Republicans, were there at that convention. That's the event that Dr. Maxwell was talking about, that Phyllis Schlafly held an anti-rally that focusing on the values as opposed to feminism as a choice.
Yeah, the parties were almost indecipherable on the issue for a really long time. I mean, they had it in their platform for like 40 years and then drop it kind of suddenly. And it was, you know, hard for Republican feminists who had been leaders for the ERA and in second wave feminism because they felt very abandoned by their party.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to play another much more recent example of what you might call coded pre-Trump racial appeals that helped lead to Trump. Listeners, you'll recognize this clip when we play it. And we also invite your questions, comments, stories for our guests from the University of Arkansas, Angie Maxwell and Todd Shields, who are authors now of The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics, with the premise being that Donald Trump is not an aberration, he's a culmination. So we invite your calls at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and we'll continue after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As we continue with Angie Maxwell, professor of Southern Studies at the University of Arkansas, and Todd Shields, the university's Dean of Arts and Sciences, they are co-authors of a new book called The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. Our phones are open for your stories, comments, questions, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, very much about decades of coded racist appeals setting the stage for Donald Trump rather than Trump being an aberration in the eyes of a lot of voters. So here's another clip, another example of what you might call coded pre-Trump racial appeals that helped lead to Trump. This is Mitt Romney's famous 47% statement. Remember, this was caught on tape at a campaign fundraiser for his 2012 presidential campaign. So he didn't say it for public consumption, but he did say it for the consumption of people he was hoping would be so dedicated to him that they would give him money. And again, this is not great audio like the last clip. It was not officially recorded, but listen closely and you'll recognize these words.
There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. But that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them.
Mitt Romney, 47% will automatically vote for Obama because they feel they're victims and the government help is an entitlement and the government will give it to them. And this is in your book, Dean Shields, but Romney didn't say anything there about race. And 47% is more than the total non-white population in the United States. So why is that in your book?
Things that the evolution of this Southern strategy has is it has people that are willing to play the Southern strategy race card really strongly, and Willie Horton's a perfect example of that, like really almost overtly. But then you have others that are kind of willing to do that, but not entirely. And so you have an example of Mitt Romney, who's moving in that direction a little bit, but not really overtly enough to really play the Southern strategy card like we're seeing with other presidential strategies.
And he loses, right? He loses. And that's the point, is that when there's these some of these Republican candidates have not wanted to do this. There's been huge chunks of the Republican Party that have fought every right turn, whether it was on race, on gender, even on reaching out to evangelical, you know, Christians. They have fought that. They have lost that fight time and time again. But there have been candidates willing to go all in, and there have been candidates who kind of hedge with it. And the ones that hedge with it, like the Mitt Romneys and John McCain, have lost, which has then, you know, kind of unfortunately given evidence to the people pushing that the party go this way, that that is the way to win, right? Which is what leads us up to someone like Trump becoming more and more overt.
So complete the narrative there, or maybe you just did, Professor Maxwell, but was Donald, you know, there's a, I think a lot of people believe, oh, Donald Trump is just being Donald Trump. If one wanted to create a strategy that looked the last 50 years of Republican presidential campaigns in the eye and said, this is where we need to go after McCain and Romney lost in order to win, they could have come up with Donald Trump. So complete the narrative. How did we get to Trump from Romney?
Well, the thing is that as the Republican Party took these positions, took these kind of right turns in the road, you know, the American people have kind of sorted themselves accordingly. And because of that, now, in 2016, people that, you know, express what we measure as racial resentment or this kind of resentment towards feminists and working women or this kind of Christian evangelical fundamentalism, that accounts for 95% of Trump's white vote, 95%. On top of that, you see Trump hiring some of the same people. So who ran Ronald Reagan's Southern campaign? Paul Manafort. Who made the Willie Horton ad? Roger Ailes, right? It's some of the same folks that have pushed, you know, candidates in these directions. And, you know, honestly, when the Southern states put their primaries, a lot of them on the same day, when the Republicans have less strict rules about kind of proportional victories in the primaries versus kind of, you know, winner take all, if you move to the far right, you capture a bigger, you know, chunk of those folks that you need early on in the campaign. It's not that it can't be beaten. It would just have to be that every other Republican got behind one other candidate. When it's fractured, like it was in 2016, you know, Trump's 35% and 40% in primaries is enough.
Here's another way to complete the narrative. A clip from this week from one of President Trump's immigration officials, Ken Cuccinelli, where after some of the proposed restrictions on legal immigrants coming to or staying in this country, Cuccinelli was asked, well, what about the Statue of Liberty? If you want to exclude people who get government benefits, which actually brings us back to Mitt Romney's 47%, if they want to kick out immigrants who get government benefits or not allow in immigrants who they deem at risk of being poor, what about the Statue of Liberty's inscription, give me you're tired, you're poor? And Cuccinelli said this.
That poem was referring back to people coming from Europe where they had class-based societies where people were considered wretched if they weren't in the right class. And it was written one year after the first federal public charge rule was written that says, and I'll quote it, any person unable to take care of himself without becoming a public charge, unquote, would be inadmissible.
The fact that he referred to it being about people from Europe, did you hear that, Dean Shields, as being racially coded and part of this same set of pieces of rhetoric?
Well, of course, yes, I did. Because, you know, if we're saying that, look, we were looking for immigrants from Western Europe or Eastern Europe, then were saying we weren't looking for immigrants from anyplace else in the world. And one of the things that I'd like to say about is this evolution of the Southern strategies happened. It's definitely focused on Southern voters and Southern white voters in particular. But, you know, for people who agree with those types of messages or those types or have those types of resentments, that message rings clear to them as well. So, you know, if you go to Wisconsin or you go to Idaho and you see a Confederate flag someplace, you kind of wonder, why is this happening? Why is there a Confederate flag in these non-Southern states? Well, this type of rhetoric appeals to people who share those types of ideals as well.
I don't know if it was you or somebody else who I heard call Trump, you know, if Obama was our first black president, Trump is our first Confederate president.
It was Rebecca Solnit. And she's right. And it's, you know, the GOP's decision to try to win that, you know, part of the country, it's, you know, for its electoral map strategy, you know, in doing so, they didn't just kind of go south. They really became Southern. They nationalized kind of the worst aspects of Southern white identity. And that has, you know, perpetuated some of those attitudes. It taps into something, but it perpetuates it. It escalates it across the country, and it expands it into ways that kind of, you know, the long history of, you know, white violence and white, you know, racism towards African Americans that is part of the South's history, then expands to people of color, whether it's immigrants or any other kind of group, and that broadens its appeal, you know, nationally. They also really did it with a kind of Southern style, you know, the big rallies, the demagoguery, the us versus them, you know, the critiques of the press. Like, that is, you know, par for the course in Southern politics for most of its history. And so it really has, you know, kind of expanded that, you know, style nationally, you know, not to our, you know, the country's benefit, in my opinion.
We have a caller on one piece of the history that you touched on earlier. Margie Ann in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Yes, in 1978, I was a nominee for the Montana delegate to the National Women's Conference. And Phyllis Schlafly was very much at her zenith at that time and had a really large national influence on especially groups of women that were connected to churches and small, you know, sort of home-based kind of lifestyles. And they brought in truckloads of women, or not truckloads, busloads of women, to speak against the ERA and basically, it was a fear-mongering tactic that they were told their whole lifestyle would go away if they did not vote this down, and they were very vocal and very well organized. And so it supports what your speaker was saying earlier about mm-hmm. it wasn't just a Southern strategy. It crossed over into every small town in America, and it was pretty shocking because there was no reason to it. There was no reasoning with them. They were sold this kind of fear of, you know, their freedoms as women, their ability to be mothers, all of that would be gone. And it was pretty shocking to a young and idealistic college student.
Thank you so much for that oral history. And let's go to Walter in Marlboro, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Walter.
Good morning, Brian. Yes, what I wanted to mention, and this is something I just recently discovered, was the expansion of the ACA, or Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Why did so many poor states refuse to expand it, even though they were getting it for free, basically? And the main reason is because most of that expansion was going towards minorities.
You're talking about the Medicaid expansion, which was voluntary state by state, under the Affordable Care Act, and was, at least for the first years, almost 100% paid for by the federal government. Dean Shields, racial component to that?
Well, it kind of goes back to the earlier quote by Atwater that, you know, you're not saying the N-word anymore, but you are talking about tax cuts and benefits for people who are portrayed as undeserving or unworthy.
And there's a long history in the South of making sure that, you know, poor whites and African Americans did not build some kind of class-based alliance, because then the sheer numbers of people that would create, you know, would make it so politically powerful. So somehow keeping that from, you know, bonding by usually some kind of use of whiteness or demonizing of, you know, blackness as undeserving is one of the things that continues to, perpetuate that there's not some kind of class alliance.
Julian Hastings has a class alliance comment, I think. Julie, you're on WNYC. Hello. Julie, are you there? Julie once. Julie twice. David in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. My question relates to a phenomenon that took place, it started around the 1970s, continued through the 80s and 90s. Whatever happened and what effect has all of this strategy had on the old New South Democrat, people like Dale Bumpers and Jimmy Carter and even Bill Clinton? That seems to have disappeared over the last 10 or 15 years.
It's a great question. And Professor Maxwell, maybe we're giving short shrift, actually, to the, quote, new Southern Democrat, the new, you know, generation that supposedly was coming up, as the caller describes, of, yeah, it was, you know, Jim Crow was really bad. Slavery obviously was really bad. And we're going to try to be done with all that now.
Well, we definitely had, I mean, Southern Democrats, Southern white Democrats, you know, kind of really split. A whole bunch flipped and became Republican, and others tried to kind of, you know, move the South forward. The problem is as the national appeal by Republicans really tried to tap into those and keep some of those racial and gendered grievances going, you know, they built a pretty strong infrastructure in the South. And so your New South Democrats got voted out, right? I mean, Clinton does manage to win back five Southern states, mostly because, and for a lot of the same reasons as Jimmy Carter, because he's Southern, because that, you know, kind of connection is very deep. You talk about identity politics. I mean, that's a strong one. But as the Democratic Party, you know, begins to embrace kind of, you know, more far left things, those kind of New South Democrats existed but didn't have enough votes.
We're just about out of time, but I'm just curious how your book is going over in your hometowns. If your professors, one professor, one dean at the University of Arkansas, Professor Maxwell, you're specifically a professor of Southern Studies, and this book, The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics, is pretty critical of Southern whites in general, you know, as well as the GOP as an institution. Are they going to kick you out of the South for this?
Oh, maybe. No, well, I totally hear what you're saying. I think one of the messages we, you know, try to get across is, you know, these were choices, and there was a huge portion of the Republican Party that fought these every single, you know, step of the way, and it didn't have to be this way, right? Both parties could have stayed pro-civil rights and debated how you best go about, you know, policies to eliminate structural racism. We can have that debate. Both parties could have stayed pro-equal rights amendment and maybe hammered out details that people were concerned about. You know, both parties could have stayed kind of trying to reach to, you know, religious voters. And then what is kind of sad to me is that, you know, a lot of times the GOP was tapping into something that was already there, and that is true, but continuing to make people feel like their lives are at risk, they are the threat level of these, you know, issues, the fear that is, you know, that some of the Republican candidates have really pushed, you know, it really affects people emotionally and kind of living in that state, you know, of constant worry that their lifestyle is going to end. There's war on Christmas, and there's the caravan, and there's, you know, women are going to have to put their babies in government daycare if the ERA passes. You know, that kind of emergency, you know, feeling doesn't do anything to help those attitudes, you know, naturally kind of alleviate as time goes on. Party doesn't have to do that.
Dean Shields, same question. And if Trump loses, does this get discredited as a political strategy?
Well, first part, I just want to, you know, reiterate what Dr. Maxwell is saying, is that we're you know, it's a misinterpretation of the book to say that every Republican is a racist, or every Republican is a sexist, or every Republican is a Christian nationalist. That is not the case. But what is the case is that some presidents have chosen to run on that type of a strategy. And with the Electoral College map, with that as the focus, there was a successful strategy. Now, in going forward, if Trump loses, I think we're going to have to see an evolution again, perhaps another layer of the Southern strategy that we haven't thought through yet. It doesn't mean that what happened in the past was wrong. It just means that as the demographics of the South continue to change, and as strategies on both parties continue to change, we're going to see some evolution of this in the future.
Todd Shields, Angie Maxwell, University of Arkansas, and co-authors of The Long Southern Strategy, How Chasing White Voters in the South Changed American Politics. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.